This episode is sponsored by Paleo Valley's pasture-raised chicken sticks. I'm super excited to share Paleo Valley's brand new pasture-raised chicken sticks. These chicken sticks are made from 100% pasture-raised chicken and organic spices that are preserved using natural fermentation rather than preservatives. So yes, no fake stuff or additives here. These chicken sticks are sourced from regenerative family farms raised on American pastures, and each stick is free of chemicals, antibiotics, pesticides, and added hormones. Paleo Valley's chicken sticks are a perfect snack packed with 7 grams of protein and, frankly, a great value without skimping on quality. Make sure to support this podcast and head over to paleovalley.com/NWJ and use code NWJ to get 15% off your order. Thanks again for listening and supporting this podcast. If you are supplementing vitamin D, or if you're having sleep issues, maybe you can fall asleep quickly, but then you wake up in the middle of the night and you're wide awake. Maybe someone's told you that it's blood sugar imbalances and you've tried everything blood sugar related and it's not that. Maybe you've tried a continuous glucose monitor and it shows no real issues. Maybe you have been taking vitamin D for so long because of immune health, your vitamin D levels never come up in blood levels. Maybe you've heard that vitamin D, you're tracking the wrong vitamin D and you should be tracking the active form, but you're testing the storage form. This interview talks about all of these things in nuance and in great detail. Hey guys, my name is Judy Cho and I'm board certified in holistic nutrition. And I have a private practice where we focus on root cause healing. And that often starts with the carnivore cures all meat elimination diet. Today, I had the pleasure of sitting down with Dr. Stasha Gominek. She is a sleep expert. She was a neurologist that went down the rabbit hole of supporting people to get better sleep. And you will hear and learn so much about the gut microbiome, vitamin D levels, what type of vitamin D to take, if we should be taking vitamin D, and what is impacting us to get sleep, and why it's so important to be getting sleep. We talk about so many different nuances. It's such a powerful conversation. I even include how maybe some of this is getting impacted by our mind-body, our mood imbalances, and also how our environment may be impacting us to be getting better sleep. Let's get right into this interview. Hi, Stasha. Thank you so much for joining me today. I've been looking forward to this conversation about vitamin D, sleep, and all things that may be impacting our sleep. Before we get started, if you can introduce yourself to the people that are listening and watching.
Thank you for inviting me, Judy. I'm thrilled to be talking about things that overlap nutrition with sleep. So I am a neurologist. I'm a retired neurologist, and I retired because I made some discoveries in the last 10 years of my practice that impacted my patients so strongly. And that was that sleep is really the major way that we heal. And that every person who's seeing a doctor for anything that's bothering them, sleep should always be thought about as the way we have a normal body. So I made some discoveries about that, and that's what we're going to talk about. I trained in California originally, or I grew up in California, and then did some of my college training there, and then trained in Houston at Baylor, and then did my neurology residency in Boston. But I now live in Texas, and I really like where I live. I live in a small town in eastern Texas, and I have a terrific life with my husband and my cats and my guinea pigs.
Okay, well, thank you. You are the sleep expert, and I know this is a big question, but what are some of the reasons we as a society are having worse and worse sleep?
And in fact, it is a global problem. The reason, in my view, my belief system is that the sleep epidemic started in the 1980s. And one of the important things about my belief system is I lived before and after. So I was actually alive in the late 60s, early 70s when Stanford Sleep Study Center began. And my generation would have been the first sleep studies that they did. So one of the important points is we started studying sleep very late. It's only really 50 years in duration. So I think when air conditioning, sunscreen, and moving indoors because of computers, and COVID just exaggerated that, when we moved indoors, our biology stayed the same. But our biology was created when we were living outdoors. One of the most important factors is vitamin D that we make when sun touches our skin. And as we've been encouraged more and more, and I was alive when the dermatologist came out in the early 80s and said, sunburn is bad for you. But over the last 40 years, that's become more and more and more exaggerated, so that the American Academy of Pediatrics says that your kids shouldn't be touched by the sun until they're 6 months old. That is not normal. Children that did well, who had a normal immune system, were strapped on mom's back and still outdoors, because that's the way we've lived. And if you count all the hominids, all the human-like walking upright, we've been on this planet for 300,000 years. That means we lived outside like every other animal. In the final analysis, D is just one of the things that affects our sleep. So there are multiple other wavelengths of light and energy wavelengths that affect our biology. And medicine is very conservative. They are very slow to adopt things. One of the fascinating parts about being a practitioner on the internet now is people have the opportunity to talk about their published articles, to talk about their thoughts. Some of it's wacky, but it turns out that there's a lot of basic science being done about energy wavelengths and how it affects our biology. And vitamin D is a very important part, because medicine has completely ignored this hormone. And they have misnamed it a vitamin. They've considered a nutrient that has some good and bad aspects. The good aspect is lay people can go and buy it themselves. They don't need a prescription. The bad aspect is that the medicine that I was trained and is still being trained is not understanding and viewing this chemical as the hormone that it is, and does not understand the importance of it. The science is phenomenal, and it is advancing at an incredible rate. The general clinician who's having to face the patient does not know about D, and have actually been somewhat brainwashed, especially in the last 5 or 10 years.
It's perfect. I love a lot of what you just said, and I want to dig into the vitamin D a little bit deeper, and then we can come back to sleep. So first, we have been trained to say that vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin alongside A, E, and K, and now you're saying it's not. So why the distinction, and then why does it even matter if it's a hormone versus a vitamin?
Great question. The confusing part of this is that we have these names for things. When we have names for things, we then treat the whole group as though it's that thing and we think we know about it. So this was called a vitamin. That means that for the last really 20 years, the prospective controlled trials, that means we have many, many articles showing that vitamin D deficiency exists next to 100 different diseases. These are called epidemiologic studies, where is there a correlation? If your D is low, are you at higher risk for diabetes? If your D is low, are you at higher risk for miscarriage? There are hundreds of studies. Those all show that vitamin D is involved in multiple organs in the body, and it plays a bunch of roles. Unfortunately, the studies that are done to help the clinician know how to use this chemical. So my job as a clinician is I read the science, I read the articles, but the very logical question they have is, well, if diabetes is associated with a low vitamin D, then you should be able to give vitamin D to prevent the disease.
Right.
Because if I make sure they never have a low vitamin D level, then they won't get diabetes. When they do those studies, they use a fixed dose. None of the hormones are using a fixed dose. For instance, if I said, Judy, you just told me your hair is falling out and you have these palpitations and you're in a really terrible mood and your sleep is affected. And I say, you know what? That sounds like a thyroid problem, Judy. Why don't you run on down to CVS and buy some thyroid hormone and I'll see you back in a year. You would go, wait, my auntie got really screwed up when her thyroid levels were right. Aren't you supposed to draw some blood and see what my thyroid level is? Because every single hormone in our body stays within a maintained level. Too much is bad. Too little is bad. as we in medicine have started to use hormones as pharmaceuticals. So as soon as I make a thyroid hormone and I give it as a pill, as soon as I use testosterone and give it as a cream or estrogen, our patients come back and say, you know, I don't feel good in the following ways. That means the doctors actually learn that too low and too high are both wrong, that there's a normal, sustained, what's called homeostatic level that's maintained in the body. We're going to use these as drugs. We have to follow that same logic. So when I say this is a hormone to a medicine audience, so a doctor's audience, and I can try to get them to flip their mind a little bit, immediately they're going to know that you have to do blood levels. And it's the blood level that determines whether the person feels good or doesn't feel good. Also, because of their experience, if they are a general practitioner, they know that too high will give something wrong and too low will give something wrong. In contrast to that, the prospective trials are using the concept vitamin, which means that it's a public health issue. That means when they do the studies, what they do is they recruit 25, this is a very important study that was done and ended in 1999. They recruit 20,000 people and they only do the vitamin D level in 2/3 of them. We recruited 25,000 people and we published the study claiming that we studied all these people, but only 2/3 of them ever had a D level. And the mean D level was 30. That means that some of them had a D level of 50 and they weren't deficient. Others of them had a D level of 10 and they were deficient, but they never actually understand the concept that what you need to do. And unfortunately, there is a minority opinion within the literature that understands this concept clearly, that our endocrinologists and other people who have made this jump to it's a hormone, that means if you want to prevent diabetes using vitamin D, what you have to do is say, if I maintain my level between 30 and 40 over a 10-year span, or 40 or 50 or 50 or 60, will I be able to prevent this disease? That's what you must do with a hormone in order to get a good outcome. So the clinical trials that are giving everyone 2,000 IUs, but never doing a follow-up D level, never actually having the concept that it must be a level that's maintained. They're not stupid. They're not ill-intentioned. They're really smart, but they're running it as a public health issue where they're thinking, oh, this is a vitamin and we just give it to the public. And every other vitamin has a recommended daily dose. This does not, because it is a hormone. You can't give everybody the same thyroid hormone dose. You have to see how much they need and you follow up. So it's very helpful when I'm talking to a medicine crowd where I'm trying to get them to flip their thoughts, okay? The other problem is that D and vitamin A are very, very close in their physical structure. They look almost identical. Now, one of the important parts of that is humans made up the name vitamin and hormone, and they get stuck on it. Some of them are really things that we have to get from our environment or from nutrition. And vitamin A is one of those. But vitamin A also has actions like a hormone.
Right.
Vitamin A is also linked to our circadian rhythm because light comes through the eye, hits the retina, retinoids, that's what A is. Retinoids then convert that photon energy into another neurologic signal that helps connect us through the brain into a 24-hour cycle. But there's a second chemical that's also light hitting the skin. Once you look at it that way, one's a vitamin, one's a hormone. We make the second one, the D, and we have to make it. Now, we're going to talk about why it's confusing in a minute. But when we make it on our skin, then it's really not made and then stored. The word vitamin has been corrupted. And what we're told is it's fat soluble, which is true. And then the next step is we make it in the summer and we store it in the fat and use it in the winter. That is completely incorrect.
Okay.
Because there is really a D level that is promoting activity. That's the summer level. In that place where my D is, and we'll talk about that later, I am building my body. I am going outside and I'm making things and I'm doing things and I'm putting all the calories I eat into making muscle. In the winter D state, when your D is lower, you are dormant. This is the same in plants as it is in animals. This exists on our planet in order to allow us to make it through the winter. So what do you have to do to make it through the winter? One, you like to put on weight in the fall, because if you have no food, because there's snow all over the ground and there's no food, you'd like to be able to exist on a lower amount of food. That means D is directly related to the thyroid hormone. It has receptors right in the pituitary. And the way we bring down our metabolic rate is to lower the thyroid hormone, which affects every cell in the body. And it brings us into this dormant state. We don't hibernate like bears do, but in fact, this was designed so that when we were actually somewhere where we're living in our little teepee, and you've got three wives and 10 kids, and you don't get out of that teepee except, you know, once a week, and you have one piece of dried food, it allowed us to survive. It allows every other animal to survive a place, a time when there is no food. So that this distinction is really important. There are some historical reasons why it's continued to be a vitamin, but people make, one, inappropriate study design. Two, they make inappropriate comments that lead people to think things that aren't really true. And this includes a lot of the scientific researchers who are not working with D clinically. So I fell into this by accident. I was not knowledgeable in supplements, wasn't the least bit interested in D. I am a fanatic about sleep. That's what I'm interested in. Everybody in my practice who's seeing me, who I have now 2,000 sleep studies in these young, healthy people who are just seeing me for headaches, they're all abnormal sleep studies and they all have low D. I had a real simple question. What would D and the D level have to do with this? And two people came back after I recommended some D and said, you know what? In about 3 weeks, my sleep was better. My headaches went away. So there was a clinical response to just adding D, and that led to a long, complicated path.
Hey guys, just to let you know, my Carnivore Cure book is back in stock. For 9 months, it was out of print and used prices were up to $300. Make sure to get your copy today that has over 200 colored tables and graphics and over 400 pages of meaty goodness. We have a limited supply, so get your copy today on Amazon.com. And if you can leave a review, I'd be super grateful. Well, thank you for that explanation. I have a few things from just what you said. So I took some notes on, I also try to understand, since we have a practice, you know, what is the normal vitamin D level? And I see that the vitamin D council definition is deficiency is 0 to 40 ng/mL. And then they have other numbers where the normal is 80 to 100. And then the Endocrine Society of definition is insufficiencies 20 to 29. And then the Institute of Medical definition or medicine definition is something different. And its risk deficiency is less than 12. And then sufficient is 20. So it's okay, so all the, you know, the bodies that define what vitamin D levels are is not even standardized. And then separately, as you were talking about blood work, we test often, I think it's the storage form, but it's actually the active form that we maybe consider. So maybe that delineation. But the question I have, so if we were to consider it a hormone, and now that makes sense why we should look at it as a hormone, but even in the thyroid or the sex hormone space, some people seem to need more versus others, even if their TSH or their certain hormone levels aren't in the quote unquote normal range, it's where they symptomatically feel better. So then what is that balance of, okay, so this is your vitamin D and how do we know? So
those are fabulous questions. So first off, when I started to do this, I had no education. The literature was absurdly confusing. Even the names of the things, everything is called vitamin D. Accidentally, I bought a book that had 365 forms of vitamin D. Oh. Like, how could, what? Those are all pharmaceutically made types of things with different. So I'm not an endocrinologist. I am a neurologist. I did not know anything about hormones. So the person that I followed at first was a guy named John Cannell, who was the first person to put a website up that said, "Isn't this the most ridiculous nomenclature you've ever seen?" He spent a lot of time trying to understand it, and he was the guy that I was using. His comment was the 2508H is quote unquote called the storage form, and there's a transition between 2508H to 125OH, and you can measure both of those in the blood.
Yes.
Now, the problem is that in actual fact, if you read the modern literature, especially a guy named Slominski, which is ironically in a dermatology department, but this guy is a brilliant biochemist, he has shown that there is a rainbow of types of Ds that are made on our skin when we are outside. There are probably 20 or 30 types of D, that they are active in the skin and they are active in inflammation, and they have more than one receptor. There isn't just a vitamin D receptor. Everybody just stopped. Not everybody, Slominski didn't. And interestingly, D can be acted on by the same enzymes that act on the sex hormones, because D is made from cholesterol and all the sex hormones are made from cholesterol. And the enzyme that takes pregnenolone to estrogen or testosterone, that enzyme is active on D and it makes all these other Ds, and they can be measured in our blood. And he has shown what they hit, what receptor they hit. They're heavily involved in inflammation. What this means is most of the literature is ridiculously oversimplified. And the final message is we know very, very little about this chemical. Now, it's still important to us, because your first question is, which is the absurdly normal question, well, what's the normal level?
Right.
The answer is, it depends on what you're trying to do with it. But what I mentioned to you at first, which is really important, and you just reflected this, every single person who's using D has a level of physical symptomatology when it's better and when it's worse. My original question was very simple. And what happened to me was these two people came in and said, I took the vitamin D. My CPAP was helping my sleep a little. I took the vitamin D 3 weeks later. I start to sleep better and my headaches went away. Two guys told me that in 1 week. So I go to the literature. I'm big into biochemistry. And what I put in is sleep and vitamin D. No hits. This is in 2009. No hits for that. There are lots of them now. So I put in brain and vitamin D, and I get to this guy named Walter Stumpf, who has 30 years of publications about where are the vitamin D receptors. And he showed back in the 90s that there are vitamin D receptors in all the sleep switches in the brainstem. So now I have not just two guys mentioning this to me, but I have a beautiful scientific study that shows these cells are listening for a D message. Now, in the background, the next question is, well, what's the right level? And I was just as confused about it as you are. And you know what? No one agrees on what the normal level should be. But I have two things to share with you. The first one is, I had a very simple question. What if we give D and we ask everybody, how's their sleep? Like, completely simple. I have all these patients that when you ask them, how's your sleep? The majority of them say, terrible. I can't fall asleep. Or I wake up at 3 a.m. and I can't go back to sleep. Frequently, this population is young, healthy females who've had a couple of kids. They shouldn't have any medical problems. Yet, sleep disorders are extremely common in the mom and the kid. So the first question is, if everybody says over 30 is okay, well, why do these people feel so awful? Okay. And I just spent 5 years giving them CPAP if they had sleep apnea. The great majority of them did not have sleep apnea. They just didn't have the deeper phases, especially rapid eye movement sleep, which affects our mood and our memory. So these are important things that are, these women are coming in saying, I have a really bad mood and I can't remember anything. And I'm having a hard time taking care of my kids. And all we say to them is, oh, you have three kids. What do you expect? Okay. No, that's not a right answer. So ultimately I had a question. Is there a vitamin D level that would make my patients who are otherwise healthy people sleep better? So I would just send them off for a D level and they'd come back and see me every 3 months. And I'd say, okay, are you taking that D? And I go, and they go, yeah. And I'm learning what the doses should be. Because as you mentioned, each person needs a different dose. And then you have to arrive at a certain level. And then if the level doesn't really make sense for how the person feels, and your next question is, do they need a little more, a little less? And we're willing as a nutritionist, and we should be willing as a physician to have that conversation. How do you feel? Okay. Now, I didn't know how to do it. And I start with little tiny doses. And most of the time my patients would come back and say, I feel terrible. And my sleep is still awful. And I'm like, are you taking that vitamin D? And they go, yeah. And I was like, okay, you're taking 2000, right? Yeah. And we do their levels again. Their first level was 28. And we moved, that was in the fall, and we moved into the winter, and now their level is 22. I'm like, wait, the FDA says 1,000 IUs. This makes no sense. It took me 2 years to get good with the dosing. And it turns out that that blood level that you're measuring is the leftovers. When you're really deficient, you take this in by mouth or in the skin, and every cell that's using it, like billions and billions of cells that have been very deficient go, whoa, yeah. That means what you see in the blood is what didn't get absorbed into the cell. So it wasn't uncommon for the levels to go down, and everybody says they're not absorbing it. That is wrong. They absolutely are absorbing it. They're absorbing it into the cell. Now, the next step was, we actually had a clinical observation where the patient started to come back and say, you know what? 3 weeks ago, my sleep started to get better. The other thing that I know that wasn't really common at the time was you can really trust a human being's claim about their sleep. They're not stupid. They've been living in this body for a while. They can tell you details about their sleep. They know when they feel better. So that actually started to happen as D crossed 60. So 60 to 80, there's a lot about how do we tell what the upper level is. John Connell said there is no upper level, there's no toxicity. And then I could swear that he changed what he said and said, yeah, there's no toxicity, but don't go over 80. And by the time I found that, I was feeling miserable and my D level was 90. And there's a long discussion about what studies we have. But ultimately, the biologic studies show that in a normal situation where you live outdoors all the time, you cannot run your D level over 80 just by sun exposure. There are also regulatory effects that break the D down so it doesn't even get absorbed. So there is a homeostatic mechanism that was studied actually in lifeguards early in the 60s. But 60 to 80 since 2009 has maintained as making a difference in a sleep disorder. Now, does that mean that that's the ideal level for D? No, it really doesn't mean that. Because that what that implies is I have been so D deficient for so long that I have developed this really bad condition. And that probably means that my cell, what I have to do with the level is overshoot to some extent because it's they're sucking up so much D. If you look at the literature about what is the D level in hunter-gatherers who don't really even have a hut, and they've done those studies in North Africa, followed these guys around, published that, and shown that their D levels are mean. Keep in mind what I said about the mean level. The mean levels are in the 40s for the whole population. Let's say there's 85 people living in as a group. What that also implies is if you want to biohack with this, the question you'd like to ask that population is, who's the best performer? Who kills the lion? Who's the strongest? And what age are they? Because if you average in the 85-year-olds that are traveling with them, the other basic truth is, as we get into our 70s, our production of D from the same amount of sun exposure goes down. That means we don't really know what the ideal is. And I would claim that you really want to be careful with D. You should not biohack with it if there's nothing wrong with you. You should not go and just take thyroid hormone or just go and take testosterone. We know from experience that the muscle that you put on, if you're a bodybuilder, always has a downside. Hormones are always a little dangerous because they have hundreds of effects that you don't know about. That means, in my view, one, you shouldn't mess with it if you don't know what you're doing. And two, the public needs to have access to vitamin D levels, and they actually need to know another really important thing, which your question was, which one should we measure? One, the 125-OH, that's called the active chemical, that you measure in the blood, has a very limited effect. It's being secreted in the blood. That conversion from 25OH to 125OH is done in the kidney, but that sluicing through the blood is going into the inside of the bone, and it's affecting bone metabolism and a few other things. But it has nothing to do with the nervous system, which is where I live. I want to know what's happening in the brain. And it's the 25OH that has a carrier protein, like all hormones do, that floats around in the blood and then is transmitted over into the brain. It's also transmitted into multiple other organs that are not using that 125OH. They are taking in the 25OH, putting it in the cell, and they have the enzyme that converts it to 125OH, and they make that when they need it within a specific range of what am I using this for. So that means we have an idea of what the blood level is, but in fact, we don't know what the brain level is. So we know so little that we have to err on the side of asking the patient to be an active participant in this program. That means I got into having a website, having a workbook, because I soon realized that none of my colleagues are interested. They are just brainwashed. You know, in the 80s, they said, if you have a good diet, you don't need vitamins. They just made this dogmatic statement that was probably somewhat true in the early 80s. But as soon as the D went down, D actually is one of the growth factors needed to have a normal microbiome. That means the epidemic of IBS and many, many of the inflammatory diseases that we're going to talk about next is all related to the fact that you lost your bugs. Now, having a good diet does not often cure the disease because you have to bring back the normal microbiome. And in order to do that, you must have D and you must have all 8 B vitamins. So we're going to talk about that second. But in the background, that means we need to be cautious with this. There's some other aspects to testing, and I don't know if you want to get into that, but there has been a move in all the labs around the world, not just here, that when doctors started to order a lot of Ds and they didn't really know the details of this, the lab that has to shoot it into this $500,000 machine. So all of the other hormone measurements we do, whether it's estrogen, progesterone, thyroid, they have very specific molecular structures. You have to use liquid chromatography followed by mass spectrometry to have accurate levels. When you're doing that with thyroid or estrogen or testosterone, those levels are really important because you're correlating them as a clinician when you're sitting with the patient. Well, this doesn't make sense. But with the D, none of the doctors know what the right level is for all the reasons you just described. Therefore, all of the labs started to move to immunoassays, very similar to the COVID test we did at home. You put a little dropper on it, it moves, colorimetry, et cetera. They are not accurate above a level of 40. They're very inaccurate. And when I was then doing D levels in my office, what I didn't know about was all this. I'm sending them down to the lab that happens to be in my same building. I'm getting all these levels. I'm doing that for 2 years. And then my colleagues who have their own medical practice decide they want to make some money from D. So they buy a D machine and those D results 20 points off from where the other. Yeah. So if I say 60 to 80 is right for sleep, and my D level that was done in my lab through this LCMS was 60. And the other lab that the doctor just did, that their general practitioner did, it is 80. That's a huge difference. One of you go down, the other one you go up. That is still a huge problem. And that is a problem throughout the world. And the other problem is there are some of these tests that are still done by immunoassay that are more accurate than others. But it's very difficult to know when you're starting with this. I have some European clients who do not have access to this LCMS. We have to use immunoassays, and that means they have to establish their own range based on what they've done.
Couple things or many things. The first, I'll ask the first question just from what you said. If we know that symptomology is very important, why do we need then the numbers or the ranges? If I can just go by my symptoms, and I know you said sleep is just one aspect of that, but if I were to just fix my sleep with this vitamin D support, and then why do I need to know where my vitamin D levels are?
Excellent. Now, the first question is, how come no one's taught me what the symptoms are of a D that's too low. And what are the symptoms of a D too high? And are they the same? Because in thyroid, they can look real similar, okay? It turns out in D, they look real similar. They're not the same, okay? Now, each person, then the reason why we're doing levels at the beginning, it turns out, is so that the person can actually believe that this stuff that they can buy at the pharmacy, that a lot of their doctors say that's baloney, has a physical connection to how they feel. So that as they're looking at these levels and they have a sleep or they have pain or they have anxiety or they have IBS symptoms, and we're following those symptoms, we're writing them down, and then we're looking at their level and it's 35. And then the next month it's 45. And then the next month it's 55. And we're watching to see which symptoms remain and which go away. And then the next month it's 65. So the reason why there's a workbook is the hard part is I have to make that person really go through the exercise of what did I feel like on a D of 55? What did I feel like on 65? Were there things about my body that went away? For instance, I'm doing this originally with all these young, healthy females with daily headache. The weird part is you would think if they're spending all their time feeling miserable, that they would know exactly the date and the hour when their headaches went away. But they don't. They come in and they say, yeah, I don't have any headaches.
Right.
And they don't even go back and say, hey, this worked. They're so used to feeling crappy. And then I give them a drug and they feel better for like 2 years and then it goes away. That they're happy that they're better. But one of the most important parts that I've noticed is when whatever that is, X, Y, or Z, including sleep, when it goes away, we forget about it, but we're still concentrating on my toe that hurts, okay? We are really designed. So the first part is learning that these things that we call vitamins are not really, this particular one is not really a vitamin, and it has really incredible power over your body. But if you're not noticing it and writing it down, you won't make the connection. Your question was, why would I need a D level? Well, here's what happens. First, your sleep gets better if we're successful and your back pain goes away and your menstrual cycle starts to be regular and all these things happen to you. And then things start to get screwed up and you don't really know if it went too low or if it's now too high because they feel very similar. That means over time, the next step is, okay, these three things have come back. Let's do your D level and see where it is. And I want you to remember what it feels like. I'll use myself as an example. For the last 3 years or so, when my D falls from 63 to 58, I start to get a visual aura of migraine. I get this weird flickery thing that's like a quintessential textbook visual aura of migraine. And then I start to get a little headache after it. It's not terrible. In the background, I knew I had migraine. But the weird thing is my brain still knows the difference between 63 and 58, which is mind-boggling for me, okay? Now, that doesn't mean that every single person needs to have a D level of 65. It means that I still tell people, look, if your body says X, and it's different than what I tell you happened in 8,000 other people, your body is always right, okay? So let's think about it in the proper way, which is, these are the observation on all these other people. That doesn't necessarily mean it, that's going to be the case for you. But the fascinating part for me has been that this observation has been relatively constant throughout. Okay. Now there are other modifiers that you need to know about, but the reason why you need that is to say, okay, well, I just found out that my D level went to 85. And then you write down what the symptoms were that came back. Because then the next thing you do is to say, okay, now I have two data points. These are the symptoms I had when my D was too low. These are the symptoms that came right back when my D was too high. And then 4 months goes by and you feel fantastic and your sleep is wonderful. And then you start to wake up at 3 a.m. and you can't go back to sleep, which is one of my symptoms. And then you make some guesses, okay? Last winter, I was on 6,000 a day, which is what I'm taking now. And oh man, I just went to Australia and it was summer there. And I lowered my D, but now I'm confused and I don't know whether or not I got it right or wrong. And I don't know whether or not when I came back, I went back to 6,000 And so now I'm a little confused as it's too high or too low. There are observations that you made about the time of the year, what I've been doing, my dosing. Was there anything else that I did that would have affected my sleep? So it's really not the D, okay? Because there are many other things that you've run into that affect that. So then you actually have a level to go to reassure yourself that what I should do now is to go up or go down.
Okay. So then in context, it's sometimes easy to assume a symptom is because of vitamin D and it may not. So then if we're tracking and we finally find a bliss point in a sense of, okay, so I seem
a
to
a bliss
feel-
point. I love that.
Okay. Find a certain point and I feel better. And so then if things get wonky again, and if we test that marker and it's within range, so then we can actually sort of consider that maybe it's probably not vitamin D and then consider other factors. So that makes a lot of sense. What's tricky is, so I understand the endocrine system to an extent, and it's, if we know the hormones, they all play together, right? There's like conductors, if we call it the thyroid or the pituitary, but even if we consume, or if we believe that vitamin D is a vitamin, there's what we have found, what, when we do nutrient tracking, we've seen people with vitamin D, when they take it, maybe their potassium drops or their or it's a magnesium deficiency actually, or that it's a vitamin C, or maybe they have inflammation and infection, as you mentioned. So that's where it gets tricky of how do you know, and your worksheet, and that makes sense for vitamin D, but it's always my concern with vitamin D. So we generally never recommend a vitamin D too much and recommend it going out in the sun and eating more fat to convert the cholesterol because of these concerns. And there's even studies with too much vitamin D causes hypercalcemia or like kidney issues. And so I always took the more conservative approach of go in the sun, eat more fat, and then hopefully it goes up. And this is a interesting fact, but how do we know that sometimes it's not just a potassium deficiency or a magnesium deficiency or some other lurking variable that we don't know, but we're hyper-focused on vitamin D?
You are so smart. So that's what happened to me. Okay. I didn't know anything about this stuff. I didn't know anything about nutrition. I still am not well informed. And I certainly was not into supplements. Okay. So I had this ridiculously medicine-based fantasy that D was the thing that was deficient and you're just going to give vitamin D. And keep in mind that I believe that even one hormones don't fix people. Sleep fixes people. Sleep is extraordinarily complicated. And what you're doing is you're repairing every single organ in your body. That is extremely complicated. Now, one of the things that I saw when I first started was all I had was CPAP. I just became fascinated with sleep. And I noticed that when they started to use CPAP, their diabetes went away. They went down to one hypertensive medicine. Their cholesterol went down. Well, the pulmonologists, the lung doctors that were assigned this problem because the nurses called them when they stopped breathing originally are telling us it's drops in oxygen. None of my patients had drops in oxygen. It's not that. It's staying in these deeper restorative phases of sleep. The complexity of what is happening throughout your body when you get into those phases is truly overwhelming. You're really mentioning all of it. Now, if you start with that as your final goal, one, I believe that sleep is a better doctor than any doctor. In fact, doctors are trained to put a Band-Aid on a thing that went wrong.
Right.
The body is designed to keep anything from going wrong. That's miraculous. That means when I'm approaching it from that way, every time a person comes in with something going wrong, their sleep should be addressed. And if you don't have anything to do about it except CPAP, you really can't get people to go for a sleep study because that's a big pain in the rear. Now, if you're suffering from daily headache, I got everybody to go. All the ones that are in torture, they're willing to do anything. Now, that means when I start to do these studies and the CPAP is not needed because they don't have apnea, and these are all young, healthy people, they're probably at the beginning of this. And everything about this is the brain. That means I start to look for the brain. And then I start wondering, well, what's happening in this part of the brainstem where those D receptors are? Why are these people not getting paralyzed correctly? That's really a neurologic problem. That's not an airway problem. So I'm thinking about it in a totally different way. And then I do D and a D makes them better. Everything I just told you. And then at the end of 2 years, after Walter and I published this article, everything falls apart. Like, whoa, I start to get this weird buttock pain. My sleep is a little worse. All my patients start to come back and go, my D is 65. I'm just going to start this with that. I already measured it last week, but my sleep is terrible. And I have these joint pain. My hands hurt, my feet hurt, my elbows hurt. They sent me to a rheumatologist. Two gals come in with burning in their hands and feet. That is just not something that happens in normal people. They don't have diabetes. They're on B12. I am a neurologist, and my subspecialty is neuropathy. I've been doing that for 30 years. The number of people who've walked in with burning in their hands and feet over that period of time was like two.
Right.
Burning in the feet, more and more common, but burning in the hands and feet in a 40-year-old and two patients who have nothing to do with each other. So these things start to walk in because I'm thinking of the D as something that's pivotal to make repairs. Because I'm thinking about it, looking through the sleep lens, okay? I'm looking at it in a different way. I'm saying, okay, we're sleeping better. I don't want them to be unconscious. They're not laying there like a lump. They're making repairs in their body. That means they'll need more magnesium, more calcium. They're making these repairs. They will actually need all more of the B vitamins. They'll need more A and more E, because every single one of those components that we've that are pivotal for our cellular function, every single one of those, their need for them goes up.
Okay.
In the meantime, I've got various things like one of my colleagues says, you know, I'm taking that vitamin D stuff you're talking about, but if I don't have my sunflower seeds in my cereal in the morning, I get a headache. So there are every single one of these chemicals is interlocking. Also, D is affecting the hormones. That means the thyroid hormone needs to change. So the other reason why you've been conservative, because that's really, really smart, is because it's affecting these other parts of their hormonal status. Many of the women who have polycystic ovarian syndrome or very irregular periods with lots of bleeding, menopause, these are all things that, yes, it's true that menopause symptoms are linked to when the estrogen level goes down and the progesterone goes down. But it turns out there are a lot of women in my practice who say, you know what? I went through menopause and just stopped having periods. You never had a sleep problem? Nah, I felt fine. And now they're in seeing me at 72 years old because they have sleep problems and headaches now. That means we probably were not originally put together to go crazy at menopause. That means the D, when it's low, has an additional effect. It's like, are you going to pile on a few other things? Okay. So that means that managing this as a clinician, very difficult, very difficult. Now, what happened to me was somebody walked in with a book. I was desperate and my practice changed dramatically because for the first time, I'm asking my patients what they think. Mm. Like I was used to here, I'm the smart one. I have the little piece of paper with the lab results. Okay. And then you're supposed to obey what I tell you.
Right, right.
That doesn't work. No, it turns out they're living in that body and they'll come in and say, okay, well, I think my D is too low. And I look at my little chart and I'd say, I think it's too high. And you send them off. The patient was always right. They may not be able to tell me how they knew that.
Right.
And now I always ask my clients, okay, what's your gut feeling about what I just said as my recommendation? If they say, you know, I just don't think blah, blah, blah is what it is. Okay. They can't necessarily explain it, but they will have a feeling because their body is their body. That's a really different way of interacting with, I call them clients now because I'm a coach, right? And learning about how to be a coach is part of this too. Now, what happened then was somebody brought in a book about B5 deficiency, God forbid, because I know nothing about vitamins. And we went down this whole other path. The final answer to your question is, yes, there are many things that are deficient. And it's way too complicated for me to give an easy answer. But the pivotal piece is D is a growth factor for the normal human microbiome. It is one of the required things that must be above 40 because we didn't start to lose our microbiome. These chronic illnesses, there are many, many things that are reported for the first time in the 80s. chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, irritable bowel syndrome. What a goofy name. None of these have been fully explained. And that usually means we haven't really understood it yet. But that means D going low globally was really the beginning of IBS. Now we know that IBS is related to having the wrong microbiome. And we've been told that that came about from antibiotic use. And that is not correct. And I say that for two reasons. One, we now have lots of evidence that the bugs make antibiotics. Fungus makes antifungal and anti-living things. So the word antibiotic means against living things. And we actually stole the first antibiotic, penicillin, from a fungus.
Right.
What that means is if you can find a way to get the normal human microbiome back and recognize that it's variable from hour to hour and day to day, and there are things like antibiotics that affect it, but there is a normal foursome of phyla. They have been doing these hundreds of things for us, that they were an integral part of our biology. And those organisms have actually been here for billions of years. So what I discovered was that the D itself, although it is a growth factor for the bacteria, did not bring back the right bacteria. The IBS that they still had at 2 years, their lack of weight loss. So they were exercising, but they did not lose weight. This person brings me this stuff about the B vitamins, B5. And I start to read the review articles about the bees. The authors at that time, about 2013, are saying, you know, thiamine has a food source and a colonic bacteria source. Riboflavin, colonic bacteria source and a food source. Niacin, the same. Every single one of them has poop bacteria source and a food source. What if, like, I don't know if you've ever thought of this, because it took me like 6 years before. Why is there A and then 8 Bs? What's that about? Why would they clump all these together? And it turns out that they were all discovered together in a petri dish from this liquid that we were using to grow bacteria in the 1920s. That liquid was the yeast bacterial mixture that we used to make beer and bread. And there were 4 phyla of bacteria that like the D that's being secreted by the yeast. And they are then favored in this liquid mix. We use it to make beer and bread, but it was also called the anti-polyneuritic factor. You could give them this yeast-containing liquid after you sat it on the counter and had it at a very specific temperature, not too hot, not too cold, the right temperature to support bacterial growth. You could give it to these people at burning in their feet and it would go away. Now, in the background, what that means is maybe some of the right bacteria, that the key to your first question, this is way too complicated and they're all linked together. The key is if you bring back the organ of the body that was doing this in the first place, they know what to do. I don't, but they do. Like, what are the ratios of these vitamins? There are 8 of them. If they all come from the bugs, they come at specific parts of the intestine and they come in certain specific ratios to one another. We're probably never going to really get at that completely.
Sure.
But the concept was, okay, I was standing at the vitamin counter looking for this B5 because my butt was hurting me and my sleep was worse and all my patients are complaining of the same. And I go to the B complex area and I soon realize that every B complex has a different set of, they might have 3 Bs, they might have 8, they might have other things. So I happened by accident to pick up B100 and I gave it to a set of patients over 1 week only and with 400 milligrams of B5, which is the way it sits on the shelf. The way it was published in this book, the recommended dose for B5 was 400 milligrams. And by the end of the week, my restless legs was much worse. I was actually taking 500 milligrams of B5 and my patients started to come back and say, this stuff here, this pantothenic acid, this nearly killed me. I was so agitated that I only took it for 2 days and I couldn't sleep at all. I immediately had insomnia. Like, wait, this book that was brought to me says, not only does their joint pain get better, but their sleep gets better. This is a vitamin that over the last 12 years has in everyone is dose related to whether they sleep or don't sleep. And it's very, very powerful. And it is not in the food anywhere in that form. But all the literature says There is no pantothenic acid deficiency because it's in every food. And that is profoundly incorrect. Until you see the clinical response, what are you going to do? Say, no, it turns out coenzyme A is ubiquitous in all the food. But pantothenic acid is not. And there are all these articles from about the 1940s to the 1970s that really question that whole dogmatic statement. And in the last 3 years, there are now starting to be more and more articles published about five deficiency states in the brain that were found by accident. Okay, so one, when I was doing this, I was just completely blown away because I was like, this is like this D stuff where the literature is completely wrong. But that's what we've been told. And since we were told, well, doctors don't need to think about vitamins or really pay attention, then we've actually had this move towards, I'm going to doctor myself because the doctors don't know. So one, if you're profoundly interested in sleep, which is me, this one chemical, B5, when it's next to D, those two together make a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. That neurotransmitter turns out to be very important. It runs paralysis in sleep. It runs our ability to transition through the phases of sleep. And it also runs our inflammatory system. It's not the only one. There are many, many layers to that. But it has its own way of affecting the immune system. It's called the acetylcholine anti-inflammatory pathway. It affects multiple areas of the brain. And there are all these primary science articles that are documenting that ADHD, which also started to be epidemic in the 80s, is related to lack of acetylcholine in the frontal lobes. And that autism has acetylcholine deficiency. And you can give them things that duplicate acetylcholine. So one, the weird part was, I'm thinking about all these things. I didn't know any of the stuff I just told you. All I knew was my butt hurt. Now it doesn't hurt anymore, but I had to stop the 400 milligrams. There's a dose response to this one B vitamin. And the only thing I remembered from medical school was, if you give one B vitamin, you should give all of them. That's the only thing I remembered. I didn't know why, but as I use it longer and longer, my patients started to come back and say that 400 milligrams nearly killed me. But when I stopped it, all of my pain went away in 2 days. Now, that's really weird. And my colleagues already thought I was completely nuts. But there's really good science behind some aspects to that, which means that these two chemicals, B5 and D, are playing a role as they become deficient. The second thing that happened was, as I'm giving B100, I start to think, you know, what if I'm right about the fact that those probiotics that I've been spending $65 a month didn't really make a difference? I still can't eat garlic, okay? But what if the bugs that are really supposed to be the four phyla, and I got into that GI literature once I was reading about the bees, oh, there are four phyla that are supposed to be there. There's an article that beautifully done in a different way that shows that every single one of those four phyla makes at least one bee and requires another bee from one of his buddies. That was probably understood a little better in the 30s when they made these arbitrarily calling all of them eight bees, because they were all purified from the same stuff. Now, in the background, that means, wait, when they took 400 milligrams of B5, everybody was mad at me and they yelled at me and some of them fired me. And when their bugs grow back, if they stay on this B100, they're going to have a double dose because their normal bugs will grow back. We're happy. But now they're on B200, whatever the normal microbiome was supposed to make. And so I started to tell my patients, look, I'm thrilled that all your pain went away and your sleep is better. But if it comes back again, I want you to stop that B100. Okay. Because I'm thinking, so there is now plenty of literature that supports this idea. One, the first article that supports in humans that D is a growth factor, establishing the less inflammatory microbiome, was published in 2020 in response to COVID. Then now there are multiple articles that are coming out showing this particular species makes this B vitamin. And this other group published in the same year I published the second article, which was when D goes low, the microbiome goes bad, and that this is linked to heart disease, Alzheimer's disease, inflammatory diseases. It was printed as a hypothesis. There were so many things that got better and then got worse again. So in the background, your first question is still a brilliant one. What do I do about the magnesium? What do I do about the B vitamin? plans? What if I give C? How do I know how much A to give now? One, this way of looking at it explodes all the recommendations, because it means if you made the recommendations in a population that had a normal human microbiome, that is really not the same as trying to use this to heal people. Right. Because it turns out that at first I was like, well, what if there's an 18-year-old in here who's complaining that he can't sleep and he's only had that for 2 years? Like, what am I doing assuming that his microbiome is wrong? You know, how do I know that? He doesn't have any belly complaints. And then I just started to do D with them, and they would be back within 2 years with joint pain and bad things. So it became obvious to me that D by itself does not produce an illness, in my view. You get a low D of 35 every spring, okay? In April, you start to go out, you start to be in the sun. So the D was meant to go up and down. So maybe 35 for a month is no big deal. You do not lose your microbiome until the D is down in the 30s and below, over sustained for years. And I make that conclusion not because I measured it, but because the reaction in my clients is such that if you're healthy, you really don't have any of these complaints. But if you come into me with these complaints, I never really can get you fully fixed with just D. You really must get the microbiome back. Now, the next problem is when that microbiome is normal, so you have to take the B50, which is what I'm recommending now, because remember, I was on D for 2 years and then started to develop problems. That means I used up my B5 stores. There's all sorts of dogma about these are water soluble. We don't have stores. That's all wrong. We have documented B12 stores, documented C stores, documented B5 and B6 stores. There are scientific studies that really show that we have stores of these. When you don't have as much sickness, and that's the only way you can really measure the level of deficiency. How long has this person had an abnormal microbiome? How long have they been deficient in these 100 things that you're wondering about, just like I am? The clinical history is what will tell you that as a clinician. Unfortunately, most of the blood levels of all of these minerals and the B vitamins, they're worthless. They're totally worthless. They have no relevance to what that person is experiencing in the nervous system. Also, as soon as I'm changing the biochemistry of this person who has a sleep disorder to a different biochemistry, then something else is likely to go low. Okay. So as soon as we start into month four and we've stopped the B50, that's day one of the normal microbiome starting to do its job. It's only starting. That doesn't mean it's filled all the deficiency states yet. So at that point, I personally wasn't taking multivitamins, but that is a pivotal part of my program now, because you really do need to supplement all these things. And iron is another big, big player in sleep and in many areas. Now we have articles that show that if you don't have the right bugs, your body really has lost a couple of the pieces that are the messaging system between the brain, do I need iron up here, and the intestinal lining. Similarly, zinc, copper, all of those minerals that have these charges, they're very, very incorporated into the bugs. If you don't have the right species, you can't do it. The oxalates that we talked about a little bit, it's very likely that we lost the specific species that were able to handle the oxalates in the intestine, so that even if we ate a lot of it, those guys ate it up and we didn't have huge amounts being absorbed. So the endocannabinoids that are a pivotal part of brain development and a pivotal part of appetite, perception of pain, perception of sensation, all sorts of things that people don't think about when you talk about marijuana stuff. They are a normal part of a normal nervous system. Right. The raw materials for making those come from the bugs as well.
So lots of different perspectives. I appreciate you walking down that, because I just love the way your brain works, because oftentimes I have very similar experiences in my clinical practice of just, I know the science, here's what I believe, let me give it to you. And then I always make the joke, Mike Tyson always says, you know, you always have a plan until you get punched in the face. And so I totally believe that, right? So when you work with different people, they help you to learn that not everything is 100%. And so then you start being more open and flexible. A couple things. So I agree with a lot of the microbiome causing these impacts. And so then as we replete, in a sense, our vitamin D levels, then it may make changes to our B levels. And I get it. We're never going to be the ultimate chemist to understand and for every individual. And then if the individual is also unwell. So that makes a lot of sense to me. I wanted to bring up something that is a little bit more nuanced. So I agree. Maybe a long time ago, we had more bugs in our gut that allowed us to tolerate some more levels of oxalates or oxalic acid in the gut. I also think we did finagle a lot of our food system. So a lot of our plants these days are much more hybridized, GMO'd, and they're foods that not nature intended. And we have mega doses of them. And now we're spraying glyphosate, which also kills our microbiome. And then in terms of the endocannabinoid, our team is actually looking into this. That's why it's so interesting that you brought it up. But it's interesting because some of the soaps we use can actually affect our gut lining. So we are doing the research, but a lot of those sulfates and a lot of the cleaner soap products, they're stuck on our dishes and our detergents on our clothes. And then there's a lot of studies that show it is just as bad on the cell lining of your gut as if you have IBD. So it is something we're thinking about as we have protocols of how to clean the home. And so we're trying to be very mindful of the soap that they're actually using, but because it can exacerbate the gut. And you know, with everything you've brought up about how the gut is so affected, but I agree with you. I think that sleep is so important. That's where we get restorative sleep. And so for example, our boys go to this like homeschool, like micro school. And if our kids sleep late, I actually prioritize the sleep and I'll let them go to school late to get that restorative sleep. So I'm right there with you. But I wanted to bring up like a wrench in all of this. So the pituitary we know is so important. It affects thyroid release. It affects, like you said, the vitamin D stuff. There's also a hormone, which in the CIRS community or the chronic inflammatory response syndrome community, they call the melanocyte stimulating hormone, or it's MSH, but they call it the master hormone. And that hormone also affects a lot of our endocrine system. It affects our sleep, and it's also released by the pituitary. So it's really interesting. And then also the limbic system, if you've had trauma, it's all the same part of the brain. It's just interesting to know when someone says they have thyroid issues, I always think, could you also be suffering from something like CIRS or a vitamin D deficiency? Or did you have trauma in the past? Did you have head trauma? Because it's the same part of the brain that releases a lot of these things. So I'll give you an example. We had a client/patient that no matter how much she supplemented vitamin D, it would never go up. And her sleep generally was okay, but not as restorative probably as we would like. So she noticed, she first went down the rabbit hole of maybe it's my hormone. So I noticed right before my period, I noticed that if I eat a certain way, then I'll get worse sleep. So then she tried to, you know, micromanage that. And then we did the vitamin D the whole time. Again, it never went beyond, I think maybe 25, 28. And she eats a predominantly meat diet. So B vitamins is plentiful. We've tried the probiotics. We did gut supports to make sure that the meat is getting broken down. And until she fixed her home that had mold, it never went up until she did that. And once she cleaned the mold in her home and then used some binders to take out some of the fungal overgrowth or the mycotoxins, then her vitamin D went up on its own. And I think she may supplement a little bit, but now her vitamin D is probably in the 60s and she gets restorative sleep. The minute she gets exposed to mold, it impacts her again and her sleep gets wonky. And we have several people like that. And we noticed there is a correlation with that MSH marker, the melanocyte stimulating hormone, which is affected by melanin of vitamin D. So it's just fascinating because it's like, okay, which rabbit hole should we go down? But we do see a correlation that if the environment that you're breathing, the air is not clean, it absolutely impacts because it starts releasing, whether it's cytokines in the system, but it causes an inflammatory response in the system that then impacts everything and then it impacts sleep and then they can't restore their health.
Judy, I love what you said. I started with this idea when I wrote this article that, okay, it's D plus the microbiome. And soon I learned what I'm talking about is this tiny little wedge of this whole pie. And every single thing that you just said, you are obviously a very curious clinician that listens to your patients. And that means that you're going to have things where The only reason why I'm still here and you're interviewing me is I think this is a really critical little piece. Mm-hmm. But that does not deny the importance of glyphosate. It does not deny the possibility that if she has too much mold, there's a possibility that that mold eats up the vitamin D and it doesn't ever get into her body. I don't know if that's true. That's not what I saw clinically, but what I'm seeing clinically is just like the, you know, the tip of the iceberg. And I don't really have, so what I tell my clients is I'm making all this up. I'm making it up based on clinical events that are pivotal. And the reason why we're here making this stuff up is because no one's helping you.
Right.
That you've already been through all of medicine. The reason why you're popular and you're doing research is because you have a client base that isn't better.
Right.
So until we actually figure this all out, all of us should share a seat at the table. And we share this information and you show me things and I show you things. And what I've noticed is the people who are coming to me have already done paleo and they did keto and they did carnivore. And they'd been vegans in the past, and they were trying to do that to fix their sleep wasn't fixed.
Right.
And so that left me with, well, diet manipulation alone didn't do that. Let's see if there's something else. That doesn't negate the importance of the diet, because as people do this phase of what I'm doing, and they actually make their sleep better, you really can't ignore the fact that later, once you become a sleep fanatic, you will notice that your exercise and your exercise outdoors, and you should include time spent outdoors, is important. And so is your diet. And sometimes there are weirdos like us that want to know the actual biochemistry of why carnivore is better. Why is more fat better? And those of us who are interested in that are going to hone in on where does that really intersect with these neurotransmitters that I now know do this. So and there are people doing the glyphosate torture, you know, that are really trying to talk to the government and the people who produce this that are playing a huge role in our health. I am not that player. I have my little piece to contribute. But now that I am in the health and wellness area and I'm reading everybody else's stuff and watching their interviews, what I've learned is you better be humble, because you're going to learn new things all the time. Physicians, starting about 20 years ago when I was working in Silicon Valley, man, my population was all software engineers. And if they came in and said, I have blah, 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 and they gave me a literature search, I better read that. And it's really a changed relationship. So every single thing that you said, I believe is true. Every clinical observation, when I and the client are together, the client's observations, if they're careful about observing time links, they run the show. I may not know why, and I might start saying, well, that's interesting because I haven't seen that, but they'll teach us things. And it's obvious that you look at it in the same way.
No, absolutely. Related to the gut, there's so much information there. A lot of the neurotransmitters you're talking about to even support sleep, melatonin, serotonin, a lot of that, it needs to be produced in the gut. It may not go into the blood-brain barrier, but neurotransmitters communicate with each other. And so you do need a gut that's intact. And that's where I think the diet matters. And it's just, it is interesting because I am curious to see, we've tried magnesium, we've tried all the minerals, we've tried adding a little bit of fat right before bed. And then people always think because we're in the carnivore space, it's the carbs. We need the carbs to go better, to get better sleep. And it's, I know it's not that only answer because we've also tried that. And it's interesting that the goal is really to get better sleep, because just like we know the importance of the microbiome, because that's where our immune system, most of it lies. Sleep is absolutely, no one argues that that is where we get our restorative healing. And without that sleep, it doesn't matter if we figured out it's mold, if it's oxalates, if it's a vitamin D deficiencies. If you don't get sleep, you will never fully get better. And so I'm right there with you. And so, you know, as we're wrapping up then, what I'm sure people are going to ask, okay, so they'll get tested, I'm sure. But what vitamin D do you like? Do you take like the D3, K2? What types do you like? And then in terms of any other supports to try to get better sleep?
I would like to comment on something else you said that I think is really important before I go to that. And that is, whenever I try something, the most frustrating part was, if it gets better, whatever we did, it doesn't last. Like, what? We thought we had it all figured out. We added magnesium and they got better. And then we did this and they got better. What I learned over time was, especially when we're doing the B vitamins and the D, the brain will go, yeah, wow, Judy, that's the right thing to do. But then what, and I'm making this up because I don't know, but if you picture what's going on for sleep as a symphony, and there are all these people sitting on the stage and they all play these different instruments, there are really, the drowsy phase is three of this and two of this and one of this. And there's really 23 different chemicals that have to be in a specific ratio. And there are these blocks of time when your brain is supposed to be doing these certain things that have to do with repair. And each one of those blocks, like the movements in a symphony, are being portrayed with these different ratios of chemicals. That means the brain is happy with this. It's telling you, yes, up with the D was the right thing, but now I'm deficient in melatonin or magnesium. So one of the most frustrating things from a clinician standpoint is it's really picky and it'll keep telling you that it's not completely satisfied. Okay. Now, moving on to what do I use? Keep in mind that I was not knowledgeable in vitamins. I was not affected by this idea that we can't absorb vitamins. And one of the reasons why is I started with D, and D is a primary player in making the acid in the stomach. So when you look at the history of H. pylori and atrophic gastritis and all this stuff that we were taught about B12 deficiency, D is the primary player that went low, that limited the amount of acid that was being produced, that then was seen in a bunch of patients who were obese, who had gastric. So the vitamin deficiency state is not only related to the microbiome, but it's often related to the fact when the D is low, the amount of acid that's being secreted is not normal. And because the sphincters above and below the stomach are also D innervated, the sphincters are loose and the esophagus is constantly being bombarded with this acid. So frequently when I start with D, the acid reflux goes up and not down at first, and then it gets better. So in the background, there is an aspect to not absorbing, because the original studies where bariatric surgeons were, the patients were saying, I'm pooping those vitamins out into the toilet. You know, they aren't doing any good for me. It's not that we made up the idea that more expensive vitamins are better absorbed. There was a real problem there. But my experience is based on my clinical experience in my neurology practice, which is filled with people who are doing allopathic medicine. Okay. They go to the doctor. They're already on 5 medicines and they're seeing me. So I have to start with something that's as simple as possible, because they don't really want to do this in addition to their other stuff, and really cheap. So I have a whole bit of experience with cheap generic multivitamins that have a specific amount of Bs. And I also have experience with using Walmart brand or generic CVS. So I entered into this in a different way than a lot of the other supplement gurus. Okay. Now I use vitamin D3. D2 is very bad for humans and all other animals except for rats or nocturnal animals. And I use whatever I think is a dependable brand. And I, more importantly, know the dose. Same thing with the vitamins. My biggest struggle is you have to look at the back of the B complex or the multivitamin to see what the doses of these Bs are. Because if you walk into Whole Foods and you reach for their multivitamin, it will have the equivalent of B50. It has really high doses of Bs. In the right circumstance, for people who are sick, they might feel better with that. But if somebody's already converted their microbiome and they walk into, they will stop sleeping again as soon as they start that multivitamin because the Bs are too high. So I don't recommend brands. My clients don't like that. They're interested now. The people that I attract are the ones that are interested in alternative, or really not alternative. This is natural medicine. Okay. This is the natural way that we live. So they're interested in a different way, but I force them to learn about the doses of these vitamins, because I've had people almost commit suicide because they just were doing what they thought I wanted them to do, which is to buy the best multivitamin they could. And it had 250 milligrams of pantothenic acid, and they haven't slept for the last 2 weeks. That means I force them to learn the doses of at least B5 and to pay attention to using the 100% to 200% minimum daily recommended dose. Now, In the midst of all this, I've told you several things that basically explodes the whole supplement industry. Like you can't depend on the blood level. You can't really say, even if you take white blood cells and you do a cellular level, that doesn't have anything to do with the brain. What we come back to then is, one, every single person has to take responsibility for, I just started this new thing. Whether it's CoQ10 or something I've told you to take, you have to write that down on your timeline, and then you have to be paying attention to what happens to you. And you only move one variable at a time. Yes. So I don't really care what the maker has said about it. If it doesn't do good for you, you better start to learn about what pieces of this you need to learn about to feel better. How can they get instruction? This is extremely complicated. I have a workbook that takes you through the how to do it. It's not the why. You and I are all about the why. Yeah. Like, what's the detail? Okay. But most people who hear this are like, just tell me what to do. This is way too overwhelming. So I have a workbook that is now incorporated in a program. And that program has one question and answer sessions. And we've recorded all of them. They've now been put together the last 2 years. And now you can get all the question and answer sessions for the last 2 years. So any question that you may have come up with about how to do this, it'll be there. And there's a private Facebook group where you could ask other people who've been doing this. And that really has been the most effective change that I've done. So the workbook tells you what to do in a general sense. And then I do consults with people as individual consults, but I also do coaching programs with somebody with more complex issues where I kind of have to help them understand what just happened to their body. And they can get at all of that at my website, which is drgomanak.com.
And are you on any social media platforms?
To some extent, yes, I do. I am fully into YouTube at the moment. We're making tiny little 5-minute videos that are meant to be free and introduce some of the ideas and answer some of the questions in little tiny bits. I am also, each time we put one of those on YouTube, I'm putting little posts on Instagram and Facebook. And my assistant does that because I'm old. And, you know, as soon as you see my age, you're going to be like, oh, Facebook, or, you know, there's more and more comedic things told about that. But I don't really feel comfortable in those platforms. I may actually, I am about to give an interview in Instagram live. So I may start to be in that area, but currently mostly on YouTube.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to say thank you for everything you shared. And I've interviewed enough people to just kind of get a read on people. And I love that you have the disclaimer of, I'm learning this in practice, and I'm learning by learning from my clients/patients of thousands of people that teach me, this is where I might be wrong. This is where I need to be more flexible. And this is where maybe we're getting something right. Or maybe there's something more that I need to research and figure out the why, and then try to implement it, because that's exactly what we do in our practice. And it's not easy, because people want, just give me an answer. And the thing is, the more complex your case is, there's no simple answer. We could say, okay, everyone needs to fix home mold in their home. And that's true, but not everyone gets better sleep from just doing that. And we've seen that personally. So it's just this dance that we do as clinicians. But I think the fact that you are open and willing to be flexible as you hear from your clients' journeys, I think that's what makes a good practitioner, to be honest. Or maybe I'm being biased, but I think...
No, I think you're absolutely right. I realize that I really am much more successful if somebody's got a naturopath and a nutritionist. And that's how I learned about the oxalate things just recently. And what you just described, that I get them halfway there and then they fall apart again. And it's not clear to me why. I thought I had it all figured out. Yeah. That teaches all of us. And the thing that I really like about your approach too is medicine has really minimized the value of clinical observation since I've been in practice. For over the last 30 years, the neurologists who taught me were describing neurologic illness from autopsies and their clinical evaluation. That is still the reality of our bodies. We did not make this thing. You know, I really think that in the current state, it's very reasonable for our clients to come in and say, you know, I can learn everything about refrigeration. I can go on the internet and learn everything all the way back to the very first science of refrigeration and what the parts are. And I can go on YouTube and somebody explains how to fix my refrigerator. How come you guys are so dumb.
Yeah.
I mean, in comparison, we're really stupid. That's because we didn't make this.
Right.
This is exquisitely complicated. And when you think about the fact that life is made from these little pieces of things, that is extraordinary. And we are actually observing things. That means a person's observation of what just happened to their body is really the only true window we have into that. I love the science, but in actual fact, as a clinician, there's never one variable.
Right. Absolutely. No, and you know, one thing I just want to leave this conversation with is the more that I've been going down these rabbit holes, just like you've been, it's been interesting to see it also a big factor that affects a person is also their perception of the world. So we talked a little bit about trauma, but the limbic system is our memory and our view of the world. So if we got hurt when we were younger, let's say going to the ocean, we might have a fear and we might release then cortisol just by being in the ocean. And that area is the same area that impacts sleep, the pituitary, those hormones we talked about, the thyroid. And so there's a brilliant picture. I'll try to put it here, but there's a brilliant picture where you see these two people looking at a bee. One imagines honey and the other imagines death. And then you see all the little billions of neurons as like little circles on their inside their body. And all the ones that are fearful show all these like billions or millions of neurons and cells being in a negative state and the other ones in a positive. So if somebody comes to you and is like, I'm skeptical, you can fix me with my sleep, but I'm going to try anyway. That is already at a loss compared to somebody that's like, I'm so excited to work with you. I know you're going to fix my sleep. I'm ready to go. I'm all in. Those two different, I have absolutely seen that too. And that area is the same area we talked about that affects the pituitary and the way that we view the world. And so I always tell our clients and patients, if you don't think you're going to ever get over this or whatever you're suffering from, you will never get over it. And that's a big component. So a lot of our work is not only trying to figure out the why of why is this not working, this supplement, this protocol, but it's also how do I get into your psyche to understand that you can get healed and you have to believe in it too. And that's a big part. And it's, I think that's where we put so much weight on the clinical side, because we also do blood work. We also do functional tests, stool tests, and we can fix a marker. We can absolutely do that. It does not make the person always feel better. And so that's where we value so much a person's symptoms. And we have a 300 questionnaire for all the different systems in the body, and it's all related down to symptoms. But people, because of what you just said, they don't value that part of the results compared to blood work, stool tests, hair mineral tests. They don't care as much about my results based on their symptoms that they reported. It's very interesting.
This, your observation means that you were also a good coach. One of the things that was really different in my life is I had to learn how to be a coach. And there, as you use the word nuanced, and that's what it's like with every single person.
Yes.
And that is not the way medicine is practiced now. And that means we're really another human being who has a different data set in their head and a different way of thinking, but we're holding their hand and we're paying. If we're a good coach, we're also attentive to how they're feeling that day. And you will modify what you're going to talk to them about and in what way based on how they're doing that day and all these other things that you learn about them. And that is very satisfying to me. I've become so much better at that. And I had to have coaches that taught me. It wasn't something I just inherently knew. And I completely agree with you. And I'm going to refer you all my clients that want a nutritionist.
Well, thank you. John Hopkins, we'll leave with this. John Hopkins, I just read this in a Lyme book. He says, a good practitioner is someone that treats a disease. A great practitioner is someone that treats the patient that has the disease. So,
yes.
Yeah.
That was in Baltimore. He was very much at the beginning of medicine, but medicine doesn't look at it that way now.
I know.
Yeah.
We are compartmentalized. I only work on the lungs. I only work on the brain and nothing else is connected when it absolutely is. But
plus we're the puppet of the insurance company.
And pharma and everything else. I know.
Yeah. So you and I, when we're doing stuff online, we have the freedom to do all these things that the patient really or the client really needs. I think it's very liberating.
It is. No, it's a hard job, but it's very rewarding too. So
I agree with you completely.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I will put all your information in the show notes. I think a lot of people, even our practice, a big part, and you know, just being really frank, is people struggle with their sleep. And one of the things is maybe they wake up in the middle of the night. We tried blood sugar things. It's not a CGM. It's not a blood sugar imbalance. So we will absolutely try your workbook and see if people can move the needle by managing their vitamin Ds, their Bs, and then everything else that may come along with it. But I'm a fan of also tracking, because people don't know what they ate yesterday. And so I think it's important to understand, where exactly are you? And that will, at least, if anything, allow them to get better sleep. And then if they get better sleep, then a lot of things can get better, even their mood. So thank you so much for your time again.
Thank you. Thanks for asking me.
Okay, guys, I hope you enjoyed this interview. I learned so much from Dr. Stasha. She is a wealth of information. I love that she is willing to learn and always curious to learn. And I look forward to working with her more behind the scenes so that we can support you all more better. It is so important to work with people that have an open mind, because that is where we learn and we grow, and we learn so much from our clients and patients. There is no such thing as a one-size-fits-all approach for everybody. And if somebody believes that, that is an indicator of a red flag. I don't probably look anything like you, and I probably don't look anything like my next-door neighbor. And it's because of these differences that not one protocol will fix everyone, especially when we've been sick and we've been sick for long and exposed to different things and diets and traumas and such. So if we know all of that, to say that one protocol will fix everyone is probably not an ideal sense. Carnivore or a meat-only diet can do a lot of healing, because it goes down to a fundamental nutrition that can be beneficial for everyone. But beyond that, when we need healing beyond the diet, what else do we need to look at for healing? And that's where I interview people like Dr. Stasha that provides so much good information, so that hopefully you can get to root cause healing. Okay, guys, make sure to eat a lot of meat. Take care of your bodies, because it is the only place you have to live. I will talk to you later. Bye, guys. Thanks for listening to the Nutrition with Judy podcast. If you liked what you heard today, please make sure to leave a 5-star review on your favorite podcast app so more listeners like you can find the show. If you want more practitioner care and support, head over to nutritionwithjudy.com/groups so you can get more real talk about carnivore, the environment, and root cause healing. You can also find my content on Nutrition with Judy's YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Make sure to sign up for my weekly newsletter and learn more about in-depth articles with infographics at nutritionwithjudy.com/articles. You can find my two books, Carnivore Cure and The Complete Carnivore Diet for Beginners, on carnivorecure.com and amazon.com. At the heart of Nutrition with Judy's practice, our mission lies with a deep, unwavering passion for service and community. We will continue to empower you to have the knowledge and tools to live a life nearly symptom-free, because we firmly believe in healing and wellness for all.